I stop off in Thailand now, where the capital, Bangkok, continues to hold out against the floodwaters which have caused havoc in many parts of the country. 380 people have been killed during the flooding. More than 100,000 have had to abandon their waterlogged homes. Rachel Harvey, with our partner, the BBC, joined the Red Cross as they went in search of a community that was largely cut off by the floods.
We're just driving down the high street of a district in the province of Nonthaburi, which is just outside Bangkok. And people are wading through the water up to their knees. Remarkably, the traffic lights still seem to be working here, but a lot of the shops are shut. But there are people clearly still living here despite these conditions. But many are now running out of basic provisions. And, says Andy McElroy of the Red Cross, the longer it takes for the floods to recede, the harder things are likely to get.
People have been stranded for 2 weeks now, and bear in mind we are only 20 kilometres from the centre of Bangkok. It's quite extraordinary. They've lost their ability to look after themselves and their family in many cases. They're vulnerable to some diseases related to particularly the stagnant waters. So it's important that we don't go back and forget about communities like this.
The trucks have just got a bit stuck here. The water is very deep up ahead. And while the drivers have stopped to work out what to do, a group of people in boats have come up towards the truck to say, can we have some clean drinking water? So they're just handing over a few basic supplies now. The truck moves on, going more slowly as the water gets deeper, until it reaches a railway track, a rare piece of dry land. It's rapidly transformed into an impromptu distribution centre. Volunteers unload rice, tinned fish and basic medical supplies, piling up the sacks on the thin strip of land.
We've only been here about 15 minutes, but more and more people keep arriving all the time from all directions. The word has obviously gone out. They've seen the trucks arrive. People are coming up directly to the trucks, wading waist-high, chest-high in places up to the trucks.
But there are dangers lurking beneath the surface, this man tells me.
Yesterday evening, some people told me to see the crocodile.
They saw crocodiles?
Yes.
Inside this area?
Yeah. Some people told me.
Snakes and mosquitoes are threats too, as if there wasn't enough already to contend with. The stress is beginning to take an emotional toll.
I've never cried before. That I see the water just make me cry. Make me cry.
One by one, they step forward to collect their rations. The pile of food reduces rapidly. That's it. No more, she shouts. The Red Cross trucks prepare to move on, and the local residents head home, wading slowly, their precious provisions held aloft above the increasingly fetid floodwater.
It's Rachel Harvey with our partner, the BBC, reporting from Thailand, where they're dealing with flooding there. And moving on to the entirely other part of the world, we've got David Sanger with us, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. And David, we're talking to you because of what's going on in Pakistan right now. There's a lot of headlines coming out of there, numbers of high-level diplomatic talks, some of them involving Hillary Clinton, and also this admission from the Pakistani government that they could be doing more to fight Islamic militants within their country at the same time that their spy agency is accused of supporting the Haqqani terrorist network. What's going on in Pakistan?
Well, what we reported in this morning's Times is that the administration has put itself in the odd position right now of relying on the ISI, the Pakistani spy agency, to set up the negotiations not only with the Taliban but with the Haqqani network, the warlords who have done so much damage or responsible for some attacks on Americans. Even at the moment that the U.S. has accused the ISI of supporting the Haqqani network. So it's not as if the spy agency is stepping in here as an intermediary. They're clearly, or parts of them are clearly on one side, the side opposite the U.S.
So David Sanger is chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. So the issue here is that we're getting our intelligence about some pretty important things dealing with not just the Haqqani terrorist network, but is Al-Qaeda and other militants that may be staging attacks in Afghanistan from an agency which may be compromised.
Well, that's been true for many years.
Right.
But it's gotten even more complex now because now the U.S. is relying on that same agency to bring the Haqqanis to the table and to try to make sure that they are engaged in a real conversation with the U.S. about reconciliation. Well, of course, the Haqqani Network and the Taliban know that the Americans are leaving. President Obama's already laid out what the schedule is for the American departure. So one big concern is that the Haqqani Network and the Taliban may say, if the Americans are leaving, we'll tell them anything that they want to hear for the next year or so, and then they'll be out of their way.
And how is this complicated by our relationship not just with Pakistan, but Afghanistan, where the President, Hamid Karzai, said if it came down to a conflict with Pakistan, Afghanistan sides with Pakistan?
Well, President Karzai says a lot of things. I mean, a year ago he said that he might join up with the Taliban. It seems unlikely, given the tensions between Pakistan and Afghanistan over the years, that any of that could be taken very seriously.
Well, what if it's not the ISI, if it's not Pakistan's intelligence agency that the United States can rely on in terms of staging these negotiations, is there a reliable member or department in the Pakistani government that the United States could partner with?
There are many different elements that the United States could partner with, but the question is, the ISI is the only one that's got deep contacts in with the Haqqani Network, because they created the Haqqanis back in the days when the U.S. was on a different side of the Haqqanis, when they were all opposing the Soviet occupation more than 20 years ago. So, yes, there are other parts of the Pakistani government, particularly the Pakistani military, that the U.S. could ally with, and they have, and that has been successful in fighting some al-Qaeda. But without the ISI's full support, hard to imagine how this is going to work.
Well, the negotiations are problematic from the beginning to a certain extent. Either Haqqani are suspected in this attack over the weekend that killed 10 Americans in Kabul. It changes that whole phrase of not negotiating with terrorists.
It does, but, you know, there's another phrase, which is you don't make peace with your friends, you make peace with your enemies. And if they don't get conversations underway with both the Taliban and the Haqqanis, there's going to be no way that there will be a reconciliation process. Of course, that's what the Obama administration wanted to have going into this Bonn conference next month. It was supposed to be all about reconciliation.
So where do we go from here, David, at this point, if we can't trust that anything that either Haqqanis or the Taliban say at the negotiating table, where does that leave the U.S.?
It leaves the U.S. in the position of doing what Secretary of State Clinton referred the other day to as fight, talk, build, which is to say attack the Haqqanis, and they've been doing that with drones, also attack the Taliban, try to engage them in discussion in the hopes that the attacks will make it worthwhile for the Haqqanis and the Taliban to come negotiate, and then try to build something that would be lasting in Afghanistan and for the Pakistanis. The problem is the Haqqanis have their own strategy, which you might refer to as fight, talk, wait for the Americans to leave.
Which would put talk first, talk before build and fight.
It would, and it's not clear what they're building. And, you know, the waiting for them to leave is a significant issue because basically once you've announced you're leaving, which there are great political and strategic reasons to go do, you've lost a lot of your leverage.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the model here is the Viet Cong knew we were leaving in Vietnam and they were willing to go negotiate anything.
Hopefully the ending here is a little gentler. David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for The New York Times. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.